From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If there's one lesson Americans have learned in the last few years, it's that it can happen here. Big disasters, man-made like 9/11, or natural disasters like Katrina. Now, Hurricane Rita is a Category 4 storm roaring through the Gulf of Mexico. Last week, President Bush took responsibility for the government's failure in response to Katrina and said next time the military should be called in.
It is now clear that a challenge on this scale requires greater federal authority and a broader role for the armed forces. The institution of our government most capable of massive logistical operations on a moment's notice.
That something more was needed after Katrina is clear, but many Americans, including some in the military itself, wonder exactly what the president has in mind. Was this a call for the military to take over from civilian authorities in disaster? At yesterday's regular Pentagon press briefing, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld parsed the president's words.
With respect to the president's comments the other night about the armed forces conceivably having a role, as you know, at the present time, we really don't. The Department of Defense is in support, but not in the lead with respect to any of these activities.
And Rumsfeld groped for the point at which the military would be on the streets.
What ought to be the trigger, the decision point that separates one type of a disaster from something that one would characterize as having overwhelmed establish the first responders as victims themselves is something that I'm sure other people will be thinking about, and we'll see what happens.
So we're thinking about it. Are we talking just soldiers filling sandbags or law enforcement? If the disaster is big enough, when should the military step in? And what about American law and the American tradition of holding the military apart from domestic affairs? This hour on Point, old boundaries, new disasters, and the role of the U.S. military. We begin with a look at the Pentagon response to the president's proposal. I'm joined from the Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland by Tom Bowman, military affairs correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Tom, thanks for being with us.
It's good to be with you.
So we heard Donald Rumsfeld there. Do you have a broader sense of how this is going down in the Pentagon with the military? Is this same old to them, or something new, and what do they make of it?
Well, actually, I think it's more of the same old, same old. And some Pentagon officials I spoke with were scratching their head after they heard Bush's speech. He's calling for a broader role for the military, but the military has always been involved in domestic disasters, either the National Guard or the active duty military. You look back at the 1960s, some of the protests, some of the civil rights issues in Mississippi, Hurricane Andrew in the early 90s, and the Rodney King riots, too. The military was involved. The question is, are you talking active duty military or National Guard? That's the real issue here.
Is that clear from the president's remarks or from what we've heard since that evening when he spoke on Jackson Square in New Orleans?
It's really not clear what he was saying. When he says a broader role for the military, again, if you look at what's happening in the Gulf Coast now, you have more than 50,000 military personnel down there. Now, the bulk of these, about 40,000, are National Guardsmen, and they're operating under state law, the laws of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. So they are, in effect, peace officers under state law. They're assisting law enforcement. And there's no problem with that under any law.
There's the active military National Guard question, but also we just heard Donald Rumsfeld saying in his conference yesterday that at the present time, the Defense Department is in support but not in the lead. The suggestion taken, he apparently took from the president's comments, that the military might actually run the disaster relief operations, and he's saying that's new.
Well, you would never have the military in charge. The military would always be answering to a civilian official. That could be a state governor, that could be the head of FEMA, or some other agency. But you would never have a general in complete charge. That general, whoever it is, whether it's National Guard or active duty, would always be subordinate to some civilian official.
I mean, that's the way the American system works, but the president seemed to be suggesting it might be significantly further up the civilian chain than it has been in the past.
Well, you know, it's potentially you could have the defense secretary in charge of something like this, but again, it would always be a civilian. You would never have a general running around ordering people to do things above any civilian officials. You would never have a Napoleon on U.S. soil, for example.
One would hope not. And what about the issue of capacity, Tom? In the active duty military, in the National Guard, there have been these questions, first of all, in relation to Katrina, of whether the response was slowed down because we have so many troops deployed abroad right now. The National Guard has talked very specifically about equipment, communications equipment, high water trucks that it does not have. Does the U.S. military have the capacity logistically to do all these things, and can it focus both on its war role and disaster role effectively at the same time?
I think it probably can. There were a lot of Guard soldiers in the area that could be called into play, and they were called into play. There were some slowdown because there were 3,000 soldiers or so from each of Mississippi and Louisiana over in Iraq. And they had some equipment, key equipment with them, and mostly this had to do with tractors and good-sized trucks. So some would argue that there was some delay, maybe less than a day or so. But it really is, as you put your finger on the right point, it comes down to communications and coordinations. They did not have enough communications equipment. So when the communications went down as a result of the storm, the National Guard general who's in charge of the Louisiana National Guard,
right.
It took him 48 hours to assess the problem in his state. His communications went down. He had no backup. It's a serious, serious problem, and you're going to see a lot of attention on that in the coming weeks. We're talking anywhere from $1 to $10 billion to make sure the National Guard has the right communications equipment.
And not that what they have in Iraq is perfect, but we read the National Guard officer saying, our best stuff is in Iraq. It's not here. That hurt us.
Yeah, but again, we're talking more tractors, bulldozers, that kind of equipment. The communications equipment they had over there would only help within their unit, certain radios and so forth. So they could communicate within their unit of 3,000 soldiers. The real question is, you need equipment that can communicate with the governor, with the fire marshal, with the police chief, or with someone in Washington. Satellite telephones, for example, communication systems, interoperable, that can plug into everybody, FEMA to the White House, to the Pentagon, to other units in other states.
And a new level of integration between civilian and military folks there. Tom Bowman, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Tom Bowman covers military affairs for the Baltimore Sun. He spoke with us from the Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland. We are talking this hour about disaster and the U.S. military. When do you want to see soldiers on the streets, and when don't you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Richard Cohn. He's chair of the Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at the University of North Carolina. He joins us from Chapel Hill. He's an authority on the history of civilian-military relations in the United States. Richard Cohn, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Arlington, Virginia, is David Mosier. He's a senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. He co-authored the 2004 RAND study, Armed Forces for Homeland Security. David Mosier, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Richard Cohn, we should speak first just to the kind of philosophical, legal moment of tradition being made, broken, or observed here. You've watched this or studied civilian-military relations over many, many years of American history. Are we talking about something new here or not?
It depends on how we would interpret the president's statement. The focus in his statement was on logistics, and I think if it's kept in logistics, it would be fully within the American tradition. But you rightly in your setup said that there are other issues of control, who's the lead agency, who might be actually be in command of a very extensive catastrophe. And some of the scenarios in the homeland defense and the terrorism studies suggest that there could be far larger and far more extensive kinds of catastrophes that might cause the breakdown in civil authority that would be much larger and much more extensive and over a longer period of time than in New Orleans. And then it might be something different. If we're talking just natural disasters, I don't think it necessarily needs to be all that different.
The American prohibition on military involvement on the domestic front goes all the way back to the Reconstruction era, post-Civil War.
Well, it does. Actually, there are laws that go back even further that try to define under what circumstances national forces would be used in local areas. But that law, what's called the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, has generated tremendous confusion and has been misinterpreted, often purposefully, to try to keep the active duty military from having much to do with internal affairs. Some of that is of course proper and very necessary, but the origin of the act was really in an effort to prohibit local officials using federal forces nearby to enforce African American voting near the end of Reconstruction to make sure it never happened again. Really the effort to of white Southerners to get back control of their political lives.
But there's a skepticism about the federal military on the streets that I think Americans kind of have just in their bones. David Mosier, we've just got a few seconds before the break here. But in general, do you see a larger role as appropriate, necessary for the military in this era of disasters and their scale?
No, I mean, I agree with Richard. I don't think we're talking about a fundamental shift here or that a fundamental shift is required. I think we're talking about a matter of degree, and the degree really depends on, and it's a condition of how big the disaster is.
We're going to come back and look at the details of that, David Mosier, Richard Cohn. I hear a question in there about scale of involvement, scale of disaster. Listeners, we welcome you as well. Do you want to see the U.S. military ready to be on your streets at a moment's notice? Does Katrina prove that civilians can't get the job done? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a greater role for the military in domestic disaster relief, as very broadly outlined by the president standing in the streets of a ruined New Orleans last week, and what that might mean for the military and for the country. You can join the conversation. A lot of questions here. Are you with the president in saying, let's turn more directly to the military in time of disaster? Is this common sense? Or is this the surrender of an American tradition of pointing the military abroad, out of domestic affairs? And are we turning to the military because we've failed to build better civilian capacity? Or is that too much to ask? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by David Mosier, senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, and Richard Cohn, professor of history at the University of North Carolina, author of Eagle and Sword, The Federalist and Creation of the Military Establishment in America. Richard Cohn, if I may, it comes back to this issue of whether American citizens and voters listening to this should be concerned, or is this the business as usual? And I'm kind of hearing two threads in this conversation. On the one hand, there has been a tradition of military being at the ready in times of emergency or upheaval, in riots and in storms. On the other, the president's comments were just vague enough. And Rumsfeld saying, you know, we've never led, suggesting that they might be being asked to lead, have people wondering if there's some shift in the line here.
I think Americans should be concerned because it's been put on the table and there's a great deal of confusion over what the laws say, Tom. There are instances which one could envision if there were, for example, a series of biological attacks that rolled around the country or a nuclear explosion in the United States, in which people would simply turn to the active duty military and say, all right, you take over and you govern these areas. And what the long-term effects would be on American civil liberties and what it would be like to operate under that regime could be very deleterious. I think the issue essentially is how does our national leadership now begin to rethink this? There's no question that we don't want the active duty military focused on this. It would erode their capacity to do their prime functions. But we do need to rethink the role of the National Guard and its organization. Mr. Rumsfeld promised that 2 years ago, that they would review it, and nothing has really come out of that. And, of course, the National Guard traditionally and still resists being diverted from this primary warfighting reserve that it got about the turn of the 20th century. It wants to maintain that, and it always claims it can do it all. Well, we don't think it can do it all. Mr. Mosier's study has some suggestions that we ought to rethink that.
David Mosier, yeah. How about it? You looked at your study is Army Forces for Homeland Security, and I know you've looked broader than the U.S. Army among the services. What are you suggesting, proposing for military involvement in this era?
What we're proposing is that the Army and the Defense Department and the civilian leadership in the country rethink just how much they want to hedge their bets in this era of both sort of terrorist threat, if you will, and seemingly large hurricanes. Disaster response in this country has always been local first, and the military has always been called on as a resource of last resort. First, the Guard under state control, and then, if it's big enough, obviously going to the national. Either getting Guard from other states, which you've seen happening in this case, which is a relatively new phenomenon.
Well, and in part because so many of the Guard of Louisiana and Mississippi were abroad, were in Iraq.
Well, that's true. But we have to think about this in terms of, the local guys are there first and they can get there quicker. So there's sort of a speed issue, if you will, and a mass or volume of support that they can provide. A lot of states don't have that many Guard to begin with. Some small states have a few thousand fewer than 10,000.
Right.
So you don't, in some states, have a lot, and it's nice to be able to borrow from your neighbors in time of catastrophe. So there are arrangements that have been put in place and more recently to make that easy. And again, it's providing logistical support. But if that gets overwhelmed, then the active duty troops can get involved, as happened in Andrew and obviously happened here in Katrina and other places. And the question is, in what capacity are those guys coming? What are they bringing to the disaster? Most of what we see with, if you study these hurricanes and disasters, most of what the military brings is what I call strong backs, organization, and logistics. Mm-hmm. You've got guys and gals, they've got, you're filling sandbags, you're fighting for forest fires, you're providing MREs, the sort of daily reams of data we get out of FEMA and DHS about what's being done. They keep talking about the number of meals that are provided, the number of liters of water that are provided. So it's the organization, the military can come in and is organized to do these sorts of tasks. And they have logistics. They have the trucks and they know how to move things better than really any organization in the world.
You're describing the benign face and the face that anyone in a disaster at that moment would welcome. On the other hand, we saw in New Orleans that all these challenges were twinned with a public order challenge.
That's true.
People very nearly talking about shoot-to-kill orders, and when that's military. I mean, if you listen to the people in New Orleans now, the ones who have gone back, I find it very interesting. So many of them comment on how weird it is to see soldiers with their big rifles in the streets. This is not an American tradition. This is not something we're familiar or comfortable with.
No, I agree. And I've lived in countries where there are soldiers on the street with loaded weapons, and it's not a happy it always makes me feel uncomfortable. And I'm glad to see that most Americans are uncomfortable with that. I think we as a nation are, which is why I'm less concerned about Bush's comment being sort of an erosion of order as we know it, that's predominantly civilian to one that's military.
But let me ask you, on that front, I think the question in people's minds may be along these lines. If we're looking at bigger disasters, i.e. man-made terrorist disasters, or if indeed we're going to have an era of bigger storms and hurricanes, and at the same time we seem to have seen demonstrated an inadequate or maybe even diminished FEMA capacity, civilian capacity, is that necessarily going to put the military, much more frequently in a central role domestically? And what about the issue of leadership? We see people saying this is a bad precedent. It steps on state and local authority inevitably when you get the military involved heavily.
Well, but you got to be clear. The way the military is involved in this is, the state. When National Guard are operating under the command of the governor, so-called state active duty, he is allowed to enforce the law and order in his state with his guardsmen, and they can have weapons and they can use them to support law enforcement directly, to actually make arrests and
within the law,
and such. If within the law, completely within the law. When you bring guardsmen in from other states as long as they remain on state active duty and their governor allows it, they can also be used in a similar fashion, although that's a little dicier. Not in a big way, but it's there's some liability issues, et cetera. It's when you get the active duty military or the National Guard who've been federalized, that's when the posse comitatus concerns kick in, and you have to have a finding from the president that allows the military to engage in these law enforcement activities, and that's rarely done. And I don't think that President Bush was proposing that in these sorts of hurricanes. I mean, what the interesting thing here, or one of the challenges here, is that since 9/11, much of our concern about disaster response has been about terrorism, you know, the different things about a nuclear attack or a biological attack that might stress our system. We pretty much have always felt, or at least since 9/11, yeah, we know how to do the hurricanes. We know how to do the big things like that, the fires, the everyday things. But what about terrorism that's different? And much of the effort since 9/11 has been focused on those sorts of activities. Mm. And, you know, we're making progress there, but I'm not sure we're near where we need to be. What I think has gotten lost in the shuffle is that, you know, our experience tells us that it's the hurricanes that come and bite us, and it's the forest fires, and it's the earthquakes. And we have to be able to mine the store and do those things well, as we've done in the past, and, you know, never perfectly. But we need to be able to do that with more regularity and be able to count on it. And we seem to have slipped here.
And do all that without ceding authority to the military and without overstretching a military institution that is tasked in all kinds of directions right now. I think there are big questions for Americans to be thinking about here.
I agree.
In an era where this is on the table and so ill-defined. On the other hand, the need, we saw it. It was there. I want to begin to turn to our callers. Rodney's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Rodney. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing today?
We're good. What do you think, Rodney?
Well, I think one of the things, like you guys have said, looking at the National Guard is also, you know, is a good thing. However, if we notice because of the time that we're being involved in so many things, if we're going to have the result to using the military, that we should look at having this military personnel trained in dealing with civilian matters, because, of course, we know military personnel are trained for combat.
Yes.
I myself, being a retired personnel, I had to go down to Andrews during that time.
Let me ask you, Rodney, were you National Guard or active duty?
No, I was active duty military.
So you went down for Hurricane Andrew.
Uh-huh. And we've seen when we was out trying to give out water, and when we first got out with trucks to give out water, thing was women and children, pregnant women, things. We had to remove ourselves from the situation to go back and come back with arms in order to even do something of that nature, distribute water to these people, because the first thing kicked in, you know, self-survival.
You mean you felt you needed to be armed even in that home setting, because it was just a rough situation.
Right. Everybody's trying to survive. I mean, you know, and I don't think, you know, it's just human nature. You know, when we was trying to save women and children, you got some of the men, you know, hey, I need water too.
Right. You know? So look at me, soldier, and pretty soon the soldier wants to have his gun. Rodney, thank you for that call. Richard Cohn, speak to this. I'm looking here at, well, I mean, there's a whole range of people. A lot of people saying, yes, we need this. On the other hand, here's Cato Institute, libertarian. Ted Carpenter there saying this sets a very bad precedent. It tends to subordinate local and state civilian authority to military authority. Winslow Wheeler at the Center for Defense Information, it is a slippery slope. It's a slope we don't want to be on. And then voices from closer to the military community. I'm looking here, McCubbin T. Owens. He's at the Naval War College, saying, you know, we've got some cultural problems here. You begin to eat into the military's fighting spirit when you put it out there with American women and children. And he points out that you've got a military culture that, since the Cold War, has increasingly grown apart from the general American culture, and it may not be healthy to have them rubbing up against one another.
Tom, all of those are sound points. The issue, it seems to me, at heart is, do you need, what level of military force do you need to keep order? There is one, on the one hand, you have logistic needs, help for disaster relief. On the other, you have order. There is a long tradition of having to bring in active military forces occasionally, very temporarily, when order is lost.
Sometimes because of natural disaster, other times essentially uprisings, racial or labor, or you name
it. That's correct. That's correct. And particularly since the 1870s, the active duty forces have done that. But it is not a good practice. They are not trained for it. There was a celebrated incident on the Texas border when a Marine company was helping guard the border and shot and killed a man. And it's still controversial, the circumstances of that.
Yeah.
We don't want that kind of thing. And that's why even in the Constitution, the framers of the Constitution had it understood that this would be a staged business in keeping order in society. Local law enforcement, a posse comitatus of citizens, state forces, and then only in extremis, active duty national forces. Mm-hmm.
Posse comitatus, the power of the county, the local power right there.
That's
I want to get a military voice in on this conversation, if I may. We're joined from just outside Chattanooga, Tennessee, by Bob Killebrew. He's a retired colonel, served in the U.S. Infantry and Army Special Forces. He now writes and speaks on defense issues. Colonel Killebrew, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You heard the president last week. You've heard some of the conversation since then and must have had your ear to the military conversation about this. What's the attitude? Do your fellow officers, former fellow officers, you're retired now, welcome this domestic responsibility? Do they feel overstretched by it? Do they think it's within or without of the bounds of what they ought to be doing?
Well, I'd frame my reply in 3 points.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I don't quite agree with my friend Mac Owens, who says that the military culture and the civilian culture have grown so far apart that they shouldn't rub shoulders. If we've come to that point in this country, we've got more problems than just disaster relief.
Well, note that. We have to say he's not the only one who's been writing that, but we take your point, absolutely.
Yeah, nobody I know in the military feels that way. The Army in particular, even though it's a volunteer force, feels itself very much a part of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And my second point is that there's no objection at all in the military services that I have heard, active or retired, that objects to giving aid and assistance to our fellow citizens.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the Army or some other service has some agenda to prevent them from being used in disaster relief when the need is dire is just not true.
I take your point, though. On the other hand, President Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, after Andrew, also spoke of a greater military role, and we read that kind of disappeared under waves of passive resistance from the Pentagon.
Well, what you asked me for was the mood I sensed in the
services
today.
Yes, sir. We got it. And your third point?
Broadly across the services, they absolutely do not object and are happy to provide assistance to their fellow citizens.
Fair enough.
But the third point, the one that Dick raises, Dick Cohn raises,
yes,
is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, your other guests have mentioned it, if the armed services become a disaster relief organization of the first resort rather than the last resort, we have fundamentally altered some basic things about not just the services, but about our federal system.
Such as? You're saying the alteration there being a shift in weight and presence from civilian to military at home.
Absolutely. When a regular Army person or a regular service commander deploys in disaster relief, he feels himself conflicted between his regular federal chain of command, as General Honoré is serving under today,
yes,
and the civilian authorities who have the legal authority in his area to direct relief.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an uncomfortable position sometimes, but it's the correct position to be in. The federal officers who serve in disaster relief are there to support local authorities, and at least in the system the way it is designed today, that should not be reversed.
And Bob Killebrew, in brief, we've just got half a minute before the break and with you, but what about the issue of capacity? We see 60% of the Mississippi National Guard, 65% Louisiana National Guard on hand this month, the rest in Iraq. Do you see a stretch for the military, active or National Guard, in this role the president's describing?
Oh, absolutely. And this gets into the whole issue that we can talk about later about the size of the armed forces and trying to operate too close to the red line of being stretched.
Yeah, the red line, indeed. Bob Killebrew, can we keep you with us for a few more minutes?
Sure, I'll be happy to.
Great. Please stay on the line then. David Mosier and Richard Cohn, we're delighted to have both of you. We've just got to take a short break here. We will be right back. We're talking about a greater role for the U.S. military in domestic disaster relief. Listeners, you can join us. Are we turning to the military because we've failed to build better civilian capacity? Big question, does a smaller government philosophy on the civilian side mean a larger military role? Are you comfortable with that? Can the U.S. military do it all, at home and abroad? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the U.S. military and disaster and what the president proposed last week in the streets of New Orleans, quote, greater federal authority and a broader role for the armed forces. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined in this hour by Richard Cohn, professor of history at the University of North Carolina, leading academic analyst and historian of civilian-military relations in the U.S., by David Mosier, senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. He's written in depth on the role of the military in homeland security issues, and by retired Army Colonel Bob Killebrew, joining us this hour from outside Chattanooga, Tennessee, and we're delighted to have him. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Dennis is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm wondering if President Bush is even taking this issue as seriously as we all are. It struck me that this was a kind of political cover comment, just because, you know, FEMA had failed. He'd had to dump the FEMA guy and appoint an admiral.
So Brownie was out and he needed a new narrative, a new story, and this was it?
Yeah.
Well, let us pick it up. I'm not sure who to turn to there. A thought from
well, Tom,
I thought about
Cohn.
That as well.
I would say this, Tom, that may be the case, but there's been talk about revising the Posse Comitatus Act from immediately after 9/11. Senator Warner has talked about it. The whole issue of the new Northern Command's actual role is still kind of up in the air. And once you have the president making a comment like that, you know, the mighty forces and legions with their own agendas scattered throughout the executive and legislative branch get called into action. And I wouldn't underestimate the impact of that statement, whether it was a throwaway or not.
David Mosher, let me ask you, Richard Cohn is quite right. Senator John Warner, Virginia Republican, chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, saying we need to look into this. And I noticed that suddenly these laws and Posse Comitatus are being widely called archaic in Washington. That sounds like a setup for a change.
Yeah, you know, in our research, we basically have determined that Posse Comitatus, you know, if you read the act, Richard said it correctly at the beginning, that it's been misinterpreted or deliberately mischaracterized for a long time. And that's not just by civilians who don't want the military involved. It's often by, you know, the Army itself has a very sort of bright line that they've drawn. Oh, we can't do that, Posse Comitatus.
But maybe it's been misinterpreted for a reason. Maybe Americans just are genuinely not comfortable with that kind of intervention.
I agree. And as I mentioned before, I think we're all – I'm gratified that everyone's uncomfortable by the issue, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. It means that whatever changes are made, and I don't think big ones are likely, are going to be, you know, thought about carefully, and people are going to have some reactions to them. But Posse Comitatus, in our assessment, gives the president pretty much all the flexibility he needs. It basically, if he determines that there's a national security interest involved in the case of terrorism, he has a broad range of authorities that he can exercise if he chooses to do so.
But how are you interpreting what's going on here? Dennis is asking, is this eyewash? Is this political eyewash by a president who was kind of over a barrel and needed something big to say?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the president, why he had the line there, but he has raised it, and so
pretty
we need to discuss it.
Yeah.
But one thing I wanted to echo or come back to something that Bob had said, mm-hmm. where he said he doesn't know a military man, I'm paraphrasing here, mm-hmm. who would resist trying to help civilians in some sort of emergency. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true from everybody that I've spoken to in the research we've done. But they are uncomfortable about the military taking the lead in these sorts of things. If you look at the way that the Department of Defense talks about this whole set of missions, it's called support to civil authorities.
Yes.
And they have a series of missions here: military assistance to civil authorities, military assistance for civil disturbances, military support to civilian law enforcement agencies. Military support or military assistance leads all those categories. And that's the way the Pentagon views their role.
All about support. But yet we heard Donald Rumsfeld at the top saying he's not sure who's going to lead in this new paradigm.
Well, I'm not sure that, you know, I heard those statements too. And I'm not sure I didn't interpret that to say he was saying that the military should lead.
No.
I was thinking he was saying, look, you know, the president has said this, but quite frankly, I'm not sure what he was talking about. I think he was saying, I'm not sure what he was talking about.
Which is why we're talking here. I want to get some more callers in, if we may. Mark is calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm both former military and a former student of Professor Cohn's.
Terrific. And what do you see, Mark?
I have some hesitation if President Bush is talking about a more permanent mission and budget for the military in this area, because in Homeland Security, what you saw with NORTHCOM and some of the new bureaucracies created some bureaucratic friction, particularly as you're dancing around posse comitatus. And in this area, you have 50 different states with 50 different bureaucracies.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if that friction will slow down response time and something that needs to be taken care of quickly.
But the president's clearly proposing this to speed up the response, which would right. suggest you've got to give authority closer to the center, to the federal, to the national military. Is that what you're reading, Mark?
I think that's what I'm reading, but I think if he doesn't say that definitively, that gray area will create a functional friction that'll actually slow down our response time.
That is interesting. Mark, thanks for your call. Richard Cohn, a former student of yours there, with a cautionary note.
Well, I think he's made a very good point, and that is that what Katrina exposed is that the machinery has not been thought through, and the procedures. There's no question David's right that the president has all the authority he needs. And there's no question that the uniformed military itself is one of the primary stewards of civilian control in this country. They get it. They understand it. Yep. They accept it. And mm-hmm. they support it. But the question is that when you have a problem and you have all these various levels of bureaucracy and the president makes a decision to intervene, which he did not do in a timely fashion, mm-hmm. nor, it seems to me, did the governor and the mayor mm-hmm. Act in timely fashions and in coordination, you don't have a very set understanding of the machinery that's going to be called into play here to assign authority, to assign responsibility, to get clean command lines. You've raised issues of communication. Mm-hmm. You bring in guards from guard units from all over the country. And just how are you going to organize it? If you're going to play pick-up sticks in the wake of a catastrophe of that magnitude, more people are at risk and more people will die.
Bob Killebrew, from a military perspective, since 9/11 we've seen established NORTHCOM, this sort of military command focused on the homeland. That was brand new. If there's going to be more responsibility on the disaster front, does that mean more bureaucracy? Does it mean more physical assets would need to be, and more disaster, you know, relevant assets would need to be positioned for the military in the U.S.?
Well, that depends on which direction the president takes his Karl Rove moment in his speech there. The thing to remember is that NORTHCOM was established because after 9/11, we had for the first time been attacked in the continental United States, mm-hmm. and that sent shockwaves not only through the country, but especially through the government. NORTHCOM has considered, I believe, its disaster relief mission to be secondary to its mission to respond in case of attack. And its ties with the Department of Homeland Security have been tenuous at best until now. I suspect they're suddenly a lot better.
Mm. I want to try and get one more call here, if I may. Joyce is calling from Baltimore. Joyce, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
First, I'd like to say that anything that President Bush suggests, we should run in the other direction real fast. Having said that, I don't, you know, Homeland Security, terrorism and natural disasters are two very different things. And so they cannot be approached, I think, in the same way.
But they can both leave a city or more in terrible trouble and needing help.
Right. And I do agree with the first gentleman that called in that military personnel are trained in for combat. They're trained to kill. So my question is, why can't we have groups around the country, firemen, EMT, and police groups that are trained for these kinds of disasters and can you know, react quickly and get to the areas that they need to get to?
So keep it in civilian hands, please, you say. And David Mosier, how about it? You've looked specifically at this. Is that beyond imagining? It would certainly put this philosophical power issue to rest.
Right. The issue is, what sort of resources do you want to invest as a country, either civilian or military, at the local level? Because that's where disasters are local.
Yep.
It was Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
It was New Orleans. I mean, that's where the resources were needed. Mm-hmm. And states have within themselves agreements to share fire and emergency responders and state assets. And between states, they have agreements. So some of that is already really taken care of. But it's when that sharing is overwhelmed, or when the response overwhelms it. And so do you want to have in, say, New Orleans or in Louisiana, a standing force of people who are able to respond to a Category 4 or Category 5 hurricane when it comes every, you know, 60 or 70 years, or maybe it's every 6 weeks?
You're suggesting it's inefficient for every state to have its own
It would be very, very, very expensive. So what you do is you have your fire guys sized basically to meet your city's demands, and then you can draw on state assets if it gets bigger than that. You can draw on the guard if it gets bigger than that. That is from the state. You can draw on guard from surrounding states if it gets bigger than that. And if it gets overwhelming, then you call on the active duty military. That's the model we've used. And really, it's a fairly efficient model.
It sounds logical. Richard Cohen, we've just got half a minute left here. Give us your historian's perspective. What do you advise citizens listening, wondering how to weigh this? Comfort with this? Wariness with this? How do you see it?
Well, my sense is they need to be very wary of changes that are undertaken by the national government, particularly legal changes, unless it's done with great care. They also ought to be asking themselves, if we have a Department of Homeland Security, why are we suddenly turning to the military in this situation, and how is this going to be coordinated?
Big questions and lines to watch out for. I'm very grateful to each of you for being with us. Richard Cohen at the University of North Carolina, wonderful to have you with us this hour. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Bob Killebrew from outside Chattanooga there. Terrific to have you with us, Colonel Killebrew. Thank you very much for being along.
My pleasure.
And David Mosier, Senior Policy Analyst at the RAND Corporation in Arlington, Virginia. Thank you for joining us, David.
It's been my pleasure, Tom.
In a moment, a military mom on the subtle ways that life as a soldier has changed her son. This is On Point. San Diego writer Sue Diaz's son, Roman, is about to head back to Iraq for a second 15-month tour of duty. 3 years ago, he was a specialist in the Army's 1st Armored Division. Now, he's got his own unit to command. In this radio diary, Sue Diaz tells us how rank isn't the only thing that has changed about this 21-year-old soldier.
Through the wavy triple-digit heat of the Mojave in midsummer, the Humvee headed our way up the long, sloping road. From the front seat of our parked car, I tracked its progress, stepping outside as it got closer. "Think that's him?" I asked my husband. "Hard to tell," he said, peering in the same direction. It was Saturday, late in the afternoon, at the main entrance to the Army's Fort Irwin near Barstow, California. Our son, Roman, a soldier with the 101st Airborne in Kentucky, was there with his unit in the middle of 3 weeks of specialized desert training. When it was finished, they'd be flying back to their Kentucky base to prepare for deployment to Iraq within weeks. It would be Roman's second tour of duty there. Earlier, just after lunch, he'd called us here at home in San Diego with the news that he'd been given the night off. He invited us to come join him for dinner, and we were happy to make the spur-of-the-moment 3-hour drive for one more chance to see him. But the plan was not without complications. When we arrived at the guard station, the MP there informed us that we wouldn't be allowed on base unless we were accompanied by our soldier. We pulled over to wait in a paved area nearby, rolled down all the windows, opened the front doors. My husband used his cell phone to call Roman on his. "Hey, all right, you made it," Roman answered. "Soon as I can find a ride, I'll be there." My husband got out, sighed, stretched, and paced. I unbuckled my seatbelt, leaned back, and took in the scene around me. Low hills dotted with rocks and scrub, trails etched into the hard, dry terrain. In spite of the boxy buildings a couple miles down the road, and all the cars and trucks passing the guard station on their way out, Fort Irwin seemed to be mostly sky and sand. In a place like that, thoughts have lots of room to wander. Mine did. To Roman, 21, and on the brink of going to war for the second time. No matter how old our children are, it's hard as a parent not to still think of them as kids. And whenever my son's been home on leave, he hasn't gone out of his way to change this view. He'll typically sleep in, shuffle into the kitchen in bare feet and baggy jeans, open the refrigerator, idle there for a while, bypass the V8 juice in favor of a can of Pepsi, schlep over to the family room sofa for some leisurely channel surfing, happy as can be to rediscover SpongeBob SquarePants. And that's okay. If anyone deserves to be cut some slack, it's a kid who's been to Iraq and back, and now is headed there again. No longer a lowly private, this time he'll be in charge of a group of men. Most are older than he is, he's told us. Some married, with children. I tried to imagine the little boy I used to call Bunky, barking orders to men carrying machine guns. Tried to picture the teenager I knew now giving instructions in how to clean a weapon, pack a duffel, carry a wounded comrade. Try as I might, I couldn't do it. And wondered if I'd ever begin to understand what he's been through and how he's changed. If I'd ever be able to see him, really see him, not so much as my son, but as someone separate from my memories, someone coming into his own in the complicated world beyond our backyard. It would require a fundamental shift in perception. And in those families where this sea change somehow happens, it means, I think, not only that the child has grown up, but that the parent finally has too. The Humvee we'd been watching stopped about a block away, just before a turnaround point. I saw the door on its right side swing open, a backpack land on the pavement, a tall soldier in camouflage khakis jump out. I would recognize Roman, I was sure, even from a distance, just by the way he moved. I looked for that ambling walk of his I knew so well. The manner in which this fellow carried himself was something else entirely. Back straight, chest out. He'd scooped up his pack with one hand, and with the other gave the hood of the Humvee an authoritative thump, then pointed as if giving directions. With a quick, full-arm wave to the guys inside, he turned and headed up the road toward us and the guard station, his stride smooth and sure. I shrugged. Not Roman. I turned to get back into the car when somebody called out. It was the soldier I'd been watching, now within hailing distance. "Hey, Mom! Dad!" I heard him say, in a voice familiar as my own.
Sue Diaz is a regular contributor to On Point. She lives in San Diego, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.